It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As legislative Republicans use Wisconsin's constitutional amendment process to pursue new laws on a range of policies, we examine this political maneuvering and how it affects states. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John Dinan is chair of the Politics and International Affairs Department at Wake Forest University in North Carolina, studies state constitutionalism, federalism, and American political development. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me today.
A newsroom here, Wisconsin Watch, reporting state lawmakers are considering as many constitutional amendments this session as they have in the past two decades combined. What is the advantage in our state of passing laws through a constitutional amendment?
Well, I guess we'd start with what would be the motivations for passing constitutional amendments. And in a situation where you have divided government, where you have the legislature controlled by one party, governor in control of another party, and perhaps a Supreme Court of a different ideological dimension, you will oftentimes see states see legislators propose amendments as a way of taking their views directly to the people and seeing if the people will ratify them. Because, of course, constitutional amendments do not get to be vetoed or signed by the governor. And constitutional amendments are superior over Supreme Court decisions at the state level. So that would clearly be motivating some of the move towards relying on constitutional amendments in Wisconsin and in some other states.
How do you feel about that sentiment that giving voters more of a voice in a time of this extreme partisanship and divided government, that makes sense?
So we really have to divide the states into the 50 states into two categories. One is that there's 17 states that actually allow voters a lot of power to actually initiate constitutional amendments. Of course, this is a power that's possessed in Ohio, Michigan, and to some degree in Illinois. It's not possessed in Wisconsin. It's not possessed in Minnesota. In those states, the people have immense amount of ability. They can bypass the governing officials altogether by proposing amendments, crafting them, putting on the ballot, and voting on them. In the other states that don't have that ability, and Wisconsin would be one of them, it does require the legislature to take the affirmative step of going to the people. In some ways, that's a recognition of the ultimate power in the U.S. political system is popular sovereignty, and it recognizes the ability of the people to approve or disapprove of those amendments. And it is very important that amendments going on the ballot is no guarantee that they will be passed. Voters are perfectly willing to vote down amendments that they find unwise or improper.
We think we feel more activity here in Wisconsin. You've been studying state constitutions for decades. Nationwide, are there more active efforts to change state constitutions now than in past times?
So if we look at the numbers, we actually see more stability than change over time. That is, every 2 years, and most states operate a two-year cycle, about 100 amendments are approved around the country. And that number has been relatively stable over the last half decade, maybe even slightly down from where it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago. But to say that the overall numbers across the country are stable is not to say that you don't see surges on particular issues and in particular states. And so we are seeing a surge right now in proposing amendments on the constitutional level in regard to abortion rights. And so we just had Ohio just last week approve an amendment to its constitution guaranteeing a right to abortion up to a certain degree. And that followed three other states that passed similar amendments just last November. And that is along with several other states that will vote next year. So you do see a surge on particular issues and in certain states. If we add things out across the country, though, more stability than change.
So let's turn to the wording. In Wisconsin, lawmakers write the questions on ballots that voters consider to either pass or reject. How often do lawmakers have the power to write ballot questions for constitutional amendments?
So when we're talking about state constitutional amendments in the 50 states, in this area, as in so many other areas, there is such a range and diversity of approaches on practically anything that we ask. How many votes does it take for a legislature to propose an amendment and put it on the ballot? How many votes does it take for the people to ratify amendments? And on this question, how is the ballot language written? There will be at least four or five different answers depending on the states. Some other states do it the way that Wisconsin does, where the legislature has control over as we pass the amendment proposal, we are drawing the language. But other states have a wide range of other procedures in which they direct the Secretary of State to draw this up, or they have a particular procedure where the matter would have to go before a state Supreme Court for review even before it could go on the ballot. Now, we shall say, even in states that don't provide for explicit Supreme Court review, there's always the possibility that a litigant could bring that case to the court system and say, I believe that this language is improper. And that has been the source of much litigation around the country.
I would imagine, I mean, every word has to be so carefully chosen so that it's accurate and descriptive enough so that the person who's reading it at the ballot box can understand what's going on.
It's a very important thing to focus on. The first question is, okay, what are we going to put on the ballot policy-wise or rights-wise? But then the next question turns to, how are we going to frame that language? We want it to be accurate, but then there's the question of, there are ways that you could use two different words to describe things, both of them be accurate. And what we know from polling, from public opinion research, voters can react very differently depending on the different framing. And so it is a critical question of how that ballot language gets written. It's no surprise that goes into court on a number of occasions, and people have very different views on what the language should be.
What I wonder, John Dinan, is should we be concerned? Should we be concerned about doing some type of damage to our state constitution, yeah, like amending it improperly or too many times, or adding things that are not really appropriate for the Constitution?
So this is a classic question when we talk about constitutional amendments, and it's probably helpful just to take a perspective here of looking at the federal level. The federal level, it's very difficult to amend the U.S. Constitution, and there's not much of an appetite for doing so. And so there have been only 27 amendments to the U.S. Constitution throughout American history. And 10 of those were the Bill of Rights that were adopted right after ratification. That means that only 17 times has the U.S. Constitution been amended in over 200 years. The situation is very different at the state level. Every single state constitution is more easily amended and is amended more often than at the federal level. So we have a different constitutional culture at the state level. That being said, there are some states where, in Texas, it's not unusual to see 9 or 10 constitutional amendments on the ballot in a given year, and people don't blink at that. They say, well, that's just what we do here. In other states, in the Midwest and in New England, if you ever saw 10 constitutional amendments on the ballot, people would say, what has happened here and what are we doing? So even within the states, there's a different approach to this. If we talk about, well, what are the advantages and disadvantages of a regular resort to the amendment process, we would say that one of the clear disadvantages is that you entrench things in a constitution and then make it more difficult if your views change on that. The upside of this is the very flip side of that. Sometimes you want to entrench things. You want to make sure that rights are protected against fleeting majorities that might change in the political process. It's a classic debate, and there are arguments to be advanced on both sides of the benefits and disadvantages of a regular resort to amending a state constitution.
Wake Forest University political scientist John Dinan studies the effects of state constitutional amendments through time. Call in with the question. Share your perspective at any point. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the legislative session underway in Wisconsin, lawmakers consider almost as many amendments as have been passed over the last 20 years combined. That's from the Wisconsin Watch newsroom. Call in with the question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John Dinan is chair of the Politics and International Affairs Department at Wake Forest University, author of books about state constitutional politics. John, turning to abortion, let's go more deeply here. You say state constitutional amendments are shaping abortion policy in the United States. Tell us what's going on.
So once the U.S. Supreme Court issues its Dobbs decision last summer and ensures that state governments are going to be primarily responsible for determining abortion policy, we now turn our attention to the various institutions and persons at the state level and the vehicles for shaping policy. Of course, legislators are some of the actors. They'll be passing abortion laws, permissive or restrictive. Of course, state Supreme Courts will be issuing decisions on the legality and constitutionality of those laws. But another vehicle is the constitutional amendment process. And so what we've seen in the year and a half since the Dobbs decision is we have seen four states now pass constitutional amendments to their state constitutions guaranteeing a right to abortion or reproductive autonomy in some fashion. And Ohio is the latest state to do so last week. This follows in the years preceding Dobbs. There were a handful of state constitutional amendments that went in exactly the opposite direction and explicitly stated that there shall not be understood to be a right to abortion in the state constitution. So we have seen state constitutions be a battleground for abortion policy, just as legislators and state courts are. We can expect to see next year and in coming years a number of additional proposals for amending state constitutions, generally for the purpose of securing extra protection or guaranteeing protection for abortion rights and reproductive autonomy. There's already a measure on the ballot in Maryland for next year, and there are other proposals as well.
I wonder how pivotal then are citizen-drafted amendments to the question of reproductive rights in the future. What do you see there?
So that the 17 states that allow for citizen-initiated vote constitutional amendments, those are oftentimes where the battleground is particularly strong. Because what happens is you can have a state where the legislature will have a certain view on abortion policy, and yet in a state such as Ohio, where the voters have the ability to put an amendment on the ballot independent of the legislature, they can basically overturn the legislature's views. And that is what happened in Ohio last week. And it's what is being proposed to happen in states such as Missouri and Florida and other states that have the voter-initiated amendment process.
Looking at voting, next year, Wisconsin voters could weigh in on at least two constitutional amendments. One would bar the use of private grants in election administration. Another would prohibit non-citizens from voting in Wisconsin elections. How common nationally are constitutional amendments about voting access or elections?
If we add up, about 100 amendments approved every 2 years around the country, voting-related amendments are pretty common, and they come in the following categories. You will see in some states establish redistricting commissions, where particularly voters are driving this, but sometimes legislatures. Let's take away from legislatures the task of drawing district lines and give it to a commission. You also see this in some cases with advancing right to vote in certain ways and removing restrictions that might be there. And then you also see it in a series of other categories. When Wisconsin voters are poised to vote on the question of basically preventing local governments or any other governments in the state from allowing non-citizens to vote, they are following in the footsteps of a handful of other states that have passed similar amendments just in the last few years, and Iowa voters will also be voting on a similar amendment next year. So what we see in the state constitutional amendment areas, you see surges of interest and groups that are recommending passage, and you see ideas circulating around the country. And so Wisconsin is more in keeping with than different from other states in seeing a surge of election-related amendments.
John Dinan studies constitutional amendments across the U.S., chairs the Politics and International Affairs Department at Wake Forest University. You can join in the discussion, call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234. John, is it more difficult to make changes to a policy once it becomes, enshrined in the state constitution?
It very much is. And so that's the classic question. If folks say, if we're dealing with, say, policy matters, is it better for the legislature to handle these and not elevate it to a constitutional status? Or is it preferable to actually entrench it in the Constitution? And clearly, one of the downsides of entrenching policy matters in the Constitution is that if you want to change that, you then have to go through the same process again of amending the Constitution. So Colorado faced this several years ago. Colorado actually put marijuana legalization in its state constitution, as some other states have done. Well, it was a very lengthy ballot measure, and they wanted to revise it several years later. They had to go through the process of thereby amending the Constitution once again to revise that. If that had rested in a legislative statute, it would not have been as difficult to do. So that's clearly one of the downsides of elevating things to a constitutional status. Do you want to entrench things in such a way that future changes require a more difficult process?
In our last few seconds together, do you think that federal constitutional amendments will gain any traction in Congress?
So to get an amendment passed through Congress requires two-thirds of vote in both houses. It's very difficult to get two-thirds vote in both houses of Congress for anything significant. So it has been several decades since we've got a federal constitutional amendment passed. Very little activity there. That's in contrast with the states where the barriers to amending state constitutions are much lower and the willingness to do so is much greater. So you see a lot of activity at the state level in various states and on various issues in terms of constitutional amendment activity. Sure. We have not seen that translate into increased federal constitutional amendment activity, given the high barriers to doing so.
John, thank you for joining us.
I was glad to have the opportunity.
John Dinan, Chair of the Politics and International Affairs Department at Wake Forest University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.